Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another week on The Main Course on heritageradionetwork.org. We've got Liz in the booth today. I'm Alexis McLaughlin, here with Philip Gilmore.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. Filling in for Patrick Martins.
Indefinitely.
Indefinitely. Or until he wants to pop in like he did last week.
That was very fun last week.
That was a good show.
He's in Isle Mirada right now?
Yeah, he's in the Florida Keys. He's been
must be nice.
Emailing about the wonderful weather
the they're
having.
The Tortuga.
Yeah, it's a blustery Sunday today. It's friggin' freezing.
Yeah, it's gonna go down to like negative 1,000.
I'm wearing double pants. I'm ready for anything. We have in studio today. We have Cecilia Estrich. I can't get that
close.
Right.
Close. Estrich.
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 And Chef Neil Harden of the Pickle Shack, and
also Jordan Haddadi.
Also Jordan Haddadi. Hi, Jordan. And we're going to talk about fine foods, rare foods, weird foods.
Fine foods and fine people.
I like that.
Yes.
Sounds right on.
So, Phil, you actually know Cecilia through Momo Sushi Shack,
yeah,
your restaurant.
I guess over 4 years now,
yeah,
I guess.
Probably.
Do you remember how we connected? Because I don't remember what the...
You know,
who
think,
or what...
I think it might have been... More than 4 years. I think right when you guys were opening, I came in. I worked at a company called Basis Foods that was a co-op called Farm to Chef.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I started working with you there.
Really? That's right.
Right before things started going haywire there and I left to go to Makuni.
Did they do mushrooms?
No. Well, limited mushrooms. We had a few like Lancaster County mushroom farms, but I think that then I was leaving Farm to Chef and Eddie Krause was your Makuni person.
I remember Eddie.
I came in with him and the rest was history.
Well, besides, you know, of course my relationship with Heritage Foods, one of the main things that I got so many connections with was when the restaurant first opened, I was obsessed with doing like a between $16 and $20 a plate mushroom tempura, like using like fine. And it was great too because I kept on just upgrading my prices. And so like I kept on like, you know, like this week I would always like chanterelles are $19 and I'd try to see who could get it for $17 and I'd just ask everyone and then, you know, so.
Well, and no, you guys were always... great supporters of everything like one-off and weird we had going for the week.
Yeah, I can remember so many good things I got from you guys, like from Solex and Makuni Wild Harvest. Like we did blue lobster from Scotland.
The blue lobster was amazing.
We did grouse, which besides the, you know, the bottle of what is it, scotch, the famous grouse. That's the only thing I knew about grouse, and it's it's a real bird.
And it's a crazy thing. It tastes like liver.
It's
like
so
super
gamey.
Iron rich and like bloody.
And don't they can't they fly like 100 miles an hour or something? They like dive bomb.
Which
things.
Is why they taste like that.
Yeah,
they like their
pure
blood's
muscles.
So oxygenated.
Yeah.
Is that a word?
Oxidized.
I think it's oxygenated. Cecilia, can we actually talk about your background real quick? Because you have a degree in philosophy, and then naturally you found yourself in the food world.
That is what most people use their philosophy degree for. It's the logical progression once you've got a bachelor's degree in philosophy to wait tables.
Can I quote Hedwig and the Angry Inch? You
please.
Can't always get what you want.
But I got out of school with sort of the vague notion that I wanted to work in the art world, and found a job at a party planning company that worked mostly with arts nonprofits. Did it for a year, hated it, but loved the food element of it, and so somehow found myself on a goat farm in Vermont making cheese, and through there everything just sort of like serendipitously came together, and I ended up working with this cooperative of farms in the area that sold to a handful of very patient, tolerant New York restaurants who are willing to take like a handwritten invoice with a amount that didn't match the products they'd received, and a delivery once like every other week at midnight or whatever. And was just sort of a great opportunity to get involved in the local food distribution world at like a very early point when there weren't that many people doing it, and there weren't that many farms involved, and there weren't that many restaurants that that were willing to operate that way. And
what year was this?
This was like 2007, maybe. Through that I met a crazy group of wild mushroom people who are based out on the West Coast in Seattle, and they also wanted to get into local food distribution in New York. And
is this Makuni?
This is Makuni. So I moved to Makuni when we sort of had like this negotiation, quid pro quo, like hard-nosed local food negotiation where they needed somebody to represent their wild forage foods in New York, and a dear friend and long-term coworker and I were like, we'll run your New York warehouse if you take on all these local farms that we've been selling and let us run this little local program. And the owner of Makuni was crazy enough to say, "Yeah, sure, go for it." And we had never run a warehouse before, and we had no idea what we were doing. But we got it to the, and again, like totally in gratitude to the patient New York City chefs who dealt with us for those 4 years. But we were able to get it off the ground to the point where, even though I don't think it was ever profitable, we had enough business that this company, Solex, was willing to buy us after 3 years. So, Solex, which was more sort of like an international fine foods company, took that over. And
when all the Scottish stuff started becoming available, was that because of Solex?
That was because of Solex.
Yeah.
So, and it's interesting how all of these little companies find ways to join forces, because the New York market is so competitive that it's really difficult to be one guy with a small, quirky product line and a single truck in New York. It's like almost impossible to make any money, which I don't know if people in the restaurant industry are aware of. Like, even if you're expensive and you're selling blue lobster, for example, for $20 a pound, like, most of those little companies make no money at all. So all the Scottish stuff was from one Scottish gentleman named Andrew Hamilton, who was a chef for many years and thought, hey, why not bring in live langoustines once a week from Scotland and like drive them around in the back of my Volvo station wagon and deliver them to Per Se. And so he fell under the Solex umbrella.
Those langoustines were so good,
so
too. I can
good.
Remember them.
They are awesome. But yeah, so Solex started sort of patchworking together all of these other small companies that did interesting things and became kind of a mid-sized company with lots of little people under the umbrella. And so, and then from there, I moved to Baldor, which is the opposite of all of those little companies. It's like a huge, organized company with like a formidable infrastructure. And I've been there for about 3 months, and it's been very interesting.
Yeah. And Baldor, you said Baldor services from Portland, Maine to Virginia?
Yep.
Wow.
We've got three warehouses. We've got one in Boston, one in D.C., and
how many restaurants do they supply? Do you know?
We have 6,000 active customers.
6,000 active customers. Wow.
Is wholesale the largest side of the Baldor? Could you guys do direct-to-consumer also, or no? It's just
no
wholesale.
Direct-to-consumer. It's not out of the realm of possibility, mm-hmm. but definitely not in the near future. So, yeah, it's all wholesale. Unlike all of the other companies I've worked for that have been very geared towards fine dining. Baldur does fine dining, but it also services institutional clients like nursing homes and hospitals and schools and corporate catering outfits and stadiums and airports. And
what are the kind of products that Baldur is doing? You know, are they, because you've worked in specialty foods and rare foods, is Baldur doing the rare foods, or are they also doing just farm to table focus?
I've been really impressed because I think most people in the industry know Baldur as a produce house that you can call at midnight to get romaine hearts and horse carrots and get it next day. And it's, I think everyone appreciates its efficiency and the consistent availability of staple product. But they also do an incredible amount of the sorts of rare, unique foods that I was doing at companies like Mikuni and Solex. And they already have a pretty impressive local food program, and their 2015, they're rolling out even more local farm partnerships. They're working really hard on sort of mobilizing their infrastructure to service the most farms possible and make sourcing local food as efficient as it can possibly be, which I think historically has been a challenge. If you're a restaurant wanting to buy locally on a consistent basis, it's not always that easy to get deliveries 5 days a week and sort of manage your pricing and not have to call 1,000 farmers and keep track of the invoices from 1,000 farmers. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, and you know, it's not easy for a wholesale company either, because wholesale is really a business of scale and volume.
Absolutely.
So if you're working with rare ingredients or local ingredients, you know, these are limited in supply. So when you're trying to scale that, it sounds like Baldur is doing some really interesting things by building that infrastructure so that they are able to produce and provide, you know, these ingredients at a scale that keeps them a sustainable business and provides, like, consistency.
Totally. I mean, you nailed it. That's the goal, is to, you know, it's even for small farmers that can't provide the type of volume that, like, a big Salinas, California-based lettuce farm can or something, I think the goal is to get those small farms sorting and grading and packing like the big farms do, and maybe consolidating product with other small farms so that there's at least enough volume and consistency to supply a big restaurant in New York, you know, and on a regular basis, as opposed to being like something that you run as a special for the weekend.
Essentially, you're creating a larger network,
mm-hmm.
almost like a cooperative. In terms is just like gets you know, the cooperative effort of you know, many different farmers to come together, because that's the only way I see to do, like, you know, scale local foods or small farms, is just to develop a network that they can all work together.
Yeah, absolutely, and all work together. And I think that what I've experienced working on the smaller, more boutique side is that there's no lack of cooperative effort among farmers themselves within their communities, and there's no lack of demand on the restaurant side. Like, everyone, I think that the entire industry is really interested in supporting local right now. But the gap is in the unsexy part of it. It's in the
paperwork.
Trucking logistics. It's in the paperwork. It's in the things you'd never think of, like cooling down lettuce so it doesn't shot 24 hours later. It's like all the infrastructure stuff that's really, like, I don't think has been there in a significant way. And I think that Baldur, because that's what they're experts in, can really fill that gap in a more material way than anyone else has been able to so far.
This is going to go down as our most interesting episode in history. I mean, I deal with a lot of the same stuff because I work for Heritage Foods USA. We are a small purveyor, and it's difficult. These are challenges that I don't think people think about when they want what they want or want local. You know what I was thinking? We're talking local, and you're from Portland, Maine to Virginia, and we're calling that local on the East Coast. Went out to the West Coast last year, and local to them is 5 miles.
Right.
There's, get any pushback for on terming stuff local because it's from the New England area?
Absolutely. And
regional?
I think that there's obviously Virginia regional would probably be a more accurate adjective. But I think that comparing California food systems to Northeastern food systems, it's impossible to do because, right now, if you're in Southern California, you're eating fava beans and apricots and stuff. And we don't have the same growing climate. We don't have the same, most of the food that we eat domestically in this country, wherever we are, comes from California in that area. And so,
Local to someone. So
well, also too, if you see, this ham was raised and cured in Canarsie. It just doesn't have the same ring as Virginia to me.
It's
yeah. I always have a little bit of a bone to pick with local because, if local is available to you, that's wonderful. Then consider yourself a really lucky individual. But for the rest of us, there's a lot of ways that local doesn't help the farmer if the farmer isn't producing enough product to, be marketable on his own, and he needs to, partner with another farmer down the road, a state over, in order to market his produce or his livestock to a company. And it's if we demand only local, are we really helping everyone that is regionally doing the best that they can?
Well, you've heard Patrick go off on his tangents about, he finds it fascinating. Even he was talking about Vermont, but you see a lot of these places where there's all this amazing meat and vegetables and stuff in the Midwest and especially Vermont. He was saying how all this great food is coming from, there's such a lack of good restaurants.
Yeah, that's also true.
He was saying in Vermont it's all just weird Pan-Asian, hybrids, Brazilian, Thai fusion restaurants. Ooh. Why in Vermont, why wouldn't you have just all farm to table restaurants, but he said it's not like that.
No, it's true. And yeah. I think that that's something that I think creating more infrastructure around regional food systems hopefully can revive towns that, don't have the market to buy any of the product that's being produced in their own areas, so many of these little towns in Vermont are just ghost towns because the paper mill or whatever the economy was in those towns has died 70 years ago. And so I hope that also through developing processing facilities and other offshoots of the agriculture economy that, those towns can come back to life too. But yeah, I think in terms of local, the Northeast does have to be more flexible in their definition of what we should be supporting, what we should stand behind. And if we're choosing to stand behind only things that come from 100 miles away, is that good for the food system in general? And I'm not sure that it's creating the type of alternate economies that can stand up against big ag or, whatever.
Yeah, stand together.
Uh-huh.
So I think we should probably go to break for a little bit and then come back and talk about more fun stories.
Yeah, I want to talk about mushrooms and salmon.
I heard mention of Twilight, too.
Uh-huh. to hear that story. Yes. I don't know if I ever got all the details of that.
Oh, really? Oh, it's kind of a good story. All right, see you in a second.
You are listening to Foolish by Besa.
Mama, hold on, you too. following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hi, this is Chad Pagano, former Army sniper, host of the Wild Game Domain, and you're listening to the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right.
Sophia and Neil are, oh, is this
And we are back.
Pure food and wine we were just talking about. That's a weird thing that happened, huh?
That's a weird thing that happened.
Yeah. You guys know about this? Everybody just walked out.
What?
Pure food and wine?
What is... What? Pure,
it's like probably, I think it's the best vegan raw restaurant that I know of, or one of them. And I guess they were not treating their employees so well, so everybody just walked out one day. And they're like in Irving Plaza. Like, it's like... You know, that's a very fancy place. Like, every time I've gone there, I've spent, even though it's vegan raw food, it's still, you know, easily 50, 60 bucks a person.
Yeah, you can get, like, a five-course tasting menu, and it was, like...
75.
And Neil was actually the chef at Pure Food and Wine for many years.
Oh, were you? Yeah. Okay, great. All right.
Yeah. And, yeah, they always had financial troubles, though, because that type of food is so labor-intensive and expensive, and...
Oh,
I'm
you,
sure
were
it was a long
you were the
time
chef
coming.
There. Okay. Yeah. That's all. Yeah, Daniel.
Many years ago, and
Daniel, man,
he worked with me there.
Is he not? Is he not the like best guy ever? Isn't he so sweet?
Yeah, and he's
we're
doing amazing food.
Gonna have to send
food,
him this episode.
Where is he now?
He lives in L.A. now, and he does these amazing multi-course tasting menus out of this crazy loft that he rents.
Because
and then
he, the wind,
beautiful food.
He was in Japan for like a year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So now he does like American style kaiseki dinners.
Yeah.
Everyone should check him out on Instagram. They're beautiful.
I'm forgetting his last name right now.
Ben Haim.
Yeah, Ben Haim. Yeah. He literally was kind of like for like a good year. He was almost like our little mascot. He would like right when he would get off Pure Wine and Food, he would be walking by and we'd always just drag him in. So he was like there was like literally weeks where he would come into Momo like maybe three times and have family meal and drink beers with us. Yeah.
Sounds like him.
So great.
That's cool.
Yeah, man. So are you vegan?
No, not so much anymore. Yeah. I'm vegetarian, but my diet is not as strict as it used to be.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, I'm kind of obsessed with vegan and vegetarian food, especially vegan and especially vegan raw, because like Momo, I'd say probably about 25% of our menu is vegan.
Yeah.
And my inspiration was for that was, well, first of all, like people always associate Japanese cuisine with like, you know, meat and sushi and all this stuff, but a large portion of it is vegan and there's, you know, so many ingredients that you can play with and do cool things.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But like, you know, like I tell people that like, okay, so you have this, you know, this $100 steak and what do? Put some salt and pepper on it.
Oh, yeah,
serve it.
It's pretty easy.
It's so easy to make like a
unless
fucking,
you're doing 50 of them at a time in a restaurant,
and that's still pretty easy. It's just like, you know, machine, you know. But to make a vegan raw lasagna that I dream about, that's hard.
I think that's, you know, a large part of why Pure Food and Wine closed is because you're making tons of components, whereas at a traditional restaurant you just need a starch, a protein, and a veg, and it's all just about like how you weigh your meat out.
So. Yeah.
But that place, we had like 8 prep cooks when I worked there, grinding it out in the morning.
Yeah. You know,
so it's a lot of labor.
A lot of love. you know, before I forget this, I kept on wanting to mention this on the first segment, but maybe you can enlighten me to the fact of the mushroom market in the United States, because I don't do it so much anymore, but I almost played it like the stock market, because at one point, like, you know, when like the Matsutake number ones came out the first week, literally, I think I would have 5 different people and I would check it literally like, you know, like I was playing like the silver and gold market, like, okay, I can get it from this price, from this person. Is there somebody out in like Washington or Oregon that like sets the daily price for mushrooms? No, because I noticed that there's
like the commodity
mushroom exchange.
Yeah, but it's serious. Like, it's literally daily, it changes. Like, okay, the Matsutake number ones are this much, and the next day they're a dollar more or a dollar cheaper.
I feel like the mushroom market is maybe more like the drug market than the stock exchange.
Kind of as a standard.
Because everyone's got like a really like occult source of where they're, like, if you talk to mushroom foragers who forage on, like, a professional level, no one will divulge where they're getting their morels, and, like, they will go out into the field. And
someone will mess you up if you mess with their spot, like, literally.
When I was at Makuni, basically what happens is people start these, like, picking encampments where everyone goes out into the field for, you know, 2 weeks. They all camp out with their trucks and their guns and just, like, harvest as many morels as possible, for example. And the two owners of Makuni are brothers, and they were out in the field with morels, and they actually got held up at gunpoint. Like, someone raided their camp and stole all their morels.
Yeah.
And drove off with them. And we had to, like, explain to customers, like, we don't have morels because the owner of the company just got robbed.
Like, at gunpoint.
I'm serious. But yeah, like, and the reason that some people, like, depending, especially when you're dealing with, like, these little mushroom companies, someone will get, like, the bargain basement price because they have special relationships with a picker in Michigan who just came on, like, a huge hoard of morels, and we were all picking in Oregon where, like, the availability is smaller, so everyone's able to charge more for them, and, like, it's all, like, geography and, like, but yeah, it's crazy, and it's all cash. Like, regular people on the weekends will go out and, like, forage as a part-time job, and then they get, like, paid cash in the field and, you know, like, a suitcase full of, like...
I don't think I realized how lucky I was when I was living in Tallahassee, Florida. Just chanterelles were just lousy with them. So after every rain, you literally go out to your front yard, go underneath an oak tree, and just find a hoard of chanterelle mushrooms. You know, fry them up in butter and put them on toast in the morning. And then I moved away from Tallahassee. I'm like, man, I'm really craving chanterelles. Like, $30 a pound.
Yeah, they can be so expensive. And you're right, though. It is crazy because, like, the first week that they pop in any given season, they'll be $30 a pound. And then you wait 2 weeks and everyone's got too many of them and they're trying to give them away. And, like, all of a sudden they're $7.99 a pound and, like... You have to be very strategic about, like, as a restaurant, how you buy them. Mm. And you have to, like, have very good relationships with your purveyors because they'll be like, man, I don't know if you want to buy them right now because I hear next week the price is going to drop.
Alexis, do you know matsutake mushrooms?
I know of them.
Yeah, because
those are my favorite.
Yeah, but you know, like, I guess it's something like you might know better than me, but, like, something like 60 or 70% of them are shipped to Japan.
I went to an auction
there once in Japan for matsutakes. They have, like, 10 different grades.
Yeah, and then they're either from the United States or some of the matsutakes that I've paid, like, you know, up to, like, $30 a pound for, you know, the short, fat, closed cap number ones. Uh-huh. Those are, like, $30, but, like, you know, when I give them to people, I'm like, okay, well, this mushroom was in Japan, this is like maybe $200 or $300 a pound, and if they're the ones that grow in Japan and they're pristine, they go up into infinity.
What prevents mushrooms from being able to be cultivated?
Magic.
I'm no expert on this, but I think that, like, it's kind of mysterious how mushrooms grow and, like,
nobody knows.
Some of them
just aren't profitable. The mushroom grower that I buy from told me that the reason bluefoots are so rare here is because nobody's found a way to make growing them profitable. So they could, they just don't.
Yeah, that's what's
not a good model.
People ask me, like, people that don't really know about truffles, like, you know, I've heard it before. Somebody said, why don't they just grow truffles? Well, the thing is that you could grow truffles, but it would cost so much money to provide the exact environment that truffles grow in that actually would make truffles be more expensive than they are, basically.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They've had success with growing black truffles.
Black truffles, yeah. But everybody knows those are the yucky ones. I'm just kidding.
Oh, you're only putting black truffles on that?
Oh, well, you know, it's the same with wasabi, which I guess, you know, there's some people in California and Washington that, you know.
Yeah, British Columbia.
British Columbia, too. There. And it's almost as good. It's, yeah. Pretty decent.
That's the only fresh wasabi I think I've ever. They're like wild water or Japanese wasabi. Yeah.
Speaking of the Pacific Northwest,
oh yeah,
yes. Oh, so when Cecilia was at Makuni, why don't you talk about how you met Jeff? Maybe talk about Jeff. Who's this guy Jeff?
So Makuni Wild Harvest has a fish expert in residence named Jeff Griffin,
and he's so awesome.
He's so awesome, and he's just like more passionate about seafood than anyone I've ever met in my life. And he has cultivated relationships with like all the family day boat fishermen in Seattle. And so he'll like, Makuni ran this program, and I think still runs this program on the West Coast, where he goes to the docks, and before all of the fishermen like sell their whole loads to big fish wholesalers, he'll like hand pick his favorite stuff off the top of all the loads and like then send you as a chef like whatever his pick is, like FedEx. So it's been out of the water for like 24 hours and it's insane fish. But he also has all these relationships with like the tribal communities who fish out there. So yeah, very Twilight. And he has an extra special relationship with the Quinault Indians. And so he gets like steelhead trout from them. And every once in a while, they'll do a live razor clam dig. And so he'll send you like, not the East Coast ones that you see a lot over here that are really thin, but like the big fat like West Coast razor clams, and he does a great job. But yeah, you got to meet him.
Yeah, so I got to meet. I was out in Seattle. My mom was there, and I surprised her for Mother's Day. And so you know, I'd done so much business, you know, in that neck of the woods. So I asked Cecilia if I could, she could hook me up, because I wanted to go meet the tribe. And is the tribe I met was the Quileute.
You met the Quileutes, okay?
And then there's the Quinault.
The Quinault, yeah, and the Quileute is a different. And okay. The Quileute does a lot of salmon.
Salmon. Well, that's that day. That's what I got. Uh-huh. So we jump in a van, and I meet Jeff on the side of the road, and we drive literally about, I think, 3.5 hours.
Really?
Oh,
so
yeah.
You guys got to know each other well.
Oh, then. Yeah. Because it's almost like, I want to say it's almost the Canadian border or something. Mm-hmm. It's way north.
It's way up there.
It's where, like, you know, where all the like little rivers and streams of Seattle and Tacoma, they all kind of come up at this giant mouth. And so we're driving up there, and we're going to the reservation, and there's literally a fork in the road, and I am embarrassed to say I have seen all the Twilight movies, but I've never read the book. but to the left, there was literally this place called Forks, and then to the right was the Quileute, reservation. And so it kind of rang a bell, all of it. I'm like, I don't know. And then the only thing that clued me off was somebody had a sign in their yard that said, no vampires. and it was just a little sign, and there was no billboards anywhere, just this one little thing. And I was like, what does that mean? And he's like, oh, well, this is Team Jacobs people from, this is the werewolves from Twilight.
Oh my gosh.
And I actually, oddly enough, was actually just reading about it this week.
And wearing your Team Jacob t-shirt.
Of course.
Top.
Obviously. Yeah.
No, well, just coincidence.
It's actually a tattoo. Yeah. People mistake it for a t-shirt because it's my full body. No, but I was just reading about them last week, and there's this little interview on YouTube with this lady who's an elder in the tribe, I guess, and she was saying how who's the author of Twilight? Stephanie Myers, I think. But just the success of the book and the success of the movies gave them a little bit of a push, and you know, to be on a national dialogue, that they actually acquired a bunch of land. And she accredits it to the name getting out there, and kind of like the branding of the tribe, and how it's like it was like a godsend for them, in an alternate universe that could have been a curse, but it, for them, I guess it really worked out.
It could have
well.
Gone either way, but yeah, like a little outsider marketing. Yeah.
So the day I went, only one boat went out, and it was they can fish 365 days a year, mm-hmm. they're immune. And so that day was not season for American people, basically. And so that day it was really rough water. So only one boat went out, and the guy that went out is named Zachary Jones. I'm going to drop his name. Hello, Mr. Zachary. Hello from New York. We love you. And this guy was the coolest guy I've ever seen. He looked like he should be like a superhero or, a male model. He's just this, big man with, like a nice beard and a beautiful face and long hair.
That's
and he
exactly
comes,
how I would
yeah,
imagine.
Yeah, and he has a Glock on him, and I can't tell you how beautiful it was. It was something like literally out of a movie, but like, you know, those giant mountains in the middle of the ocean with the trees on them. So there's crazy. Seals everywhere. There's 1,000 seagulls. And then there's like, I saw like 20 bald eagles. They're just hanging out everywhere. And it's like, I can't even believe it. He comes up, he has two salmons. And one was like 14 pounds, and I think the other was like 20 pounds. And that was basically the only two salmon that were caught that day in like, you know, within 500 miles, basically. And so they let me buy one, and they basically gave it to me at like just something really cheap. And they boxed it up for me, and I took it back to New York the next day, put it on dry ice.
Did you bring it on the airplane?
Yeah, I totally brought it on the airplane. And then Jeff sat there, and he's like, okay, so you only want one, and you want the smaller one? Yes. And then, boom, French Laundry. Got the other one.
Really?
Yeah, he sat there and brokered a deal for like, you know, $80,000 a pound, you know.
That's so funny.
Market price.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, so it's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got some pretty hoity toity customers. Jeff in particular. I think everyone loves that. The fish is so good. It's like unlike anything. Especially wild salmon. Like if you're used to eating like farm salmon from Chile or something, it's just like it's a totally different phenomenon.
By the way, if you ever get bored, just call him and ask him, so what about this salmon roe? He literally talked to me for an hour about how you cure salmon roe, and I found it fascinating.
It's true. Like, if this man like can go on for hours about like what exactly is special about everything he sells. So it's true. If you're ever bored.
But the one fascinating thing that he told me was, you know, he's like his pet peeve is, you know, the whole thing in Seattle where they throw the salmon. Mm-hmm. That's the worst thing you can do.
Because
salmon is the most delicate of fish. So he's like, even when he's carrying, he's like very like, you know, he's like packing it is so important. And because it's really made a pretty big difference because that was the best salmon. That was the best salmon I'd ever had.
He also, and I'm probably butchering this explanation, so yeah, I'm like, disclaimer beforehand, this might not be fully accurate, but he only works with fishermen who like bleed their salmon in a very particular way. They like power pump all the blood out, mm-hmm. so it doesn't like, apparently that's what makes it fishy or something. So good.
They did it right in front of me too, and there was
did you get to see it?
Yeah, and then one of them had an egg sack, you know, this just literally like the size of a basketball of roe, and they were just throwing it, and these seagulls were just like pew, 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 and then like some of them went in the water, and these seals were fighting over it. It was amazing. Yeah,
I'm jealous. I've never been out there before.
Really?
After working with them for so long, I never made it there. One day. I want
to... Do you know that me and my business partner, Chance, actually won a trip to Seattle
like
two years ago at a Heritage function? There was a raffle, and we bought like two tickets, and we were kind of drunk, and we held hands, and we started shaking. We're like, we're going to win. We're going to win. And there's like 300 people, and we're just like, we're going to win. We're going to win. We did this like voodoo thing, and everybody was like looking at us weird. And there's these four girls that were behind us that were watching us, and they were kind of laughing at us. They were laughing until Jack Inslee said, Chance Johnston, and we went, ah, these girls like, how did you do that?
You like tapped into the powers of the universe.
Yeah, literally.
Was it a Heritage Radio?
Yeah, it was I guess Tom Douglas, is that his name? What's the guy? The guy in Seattle? I think Tom Douglas, the barbecue guy out there, funded it. So
awesome.
But Patrick and Jack said it's still available, so we get to go.
You haven't gone yet?
No. Just been busy. So it's two plane tickets, hotel room, a rental car, three dinners, and then like a private tour of the Chihuly Museum or something like that.
Huh. Phil, I don't know if you realize, but this is a 501c nonprofit.
Yeah.
So if you don't claim those prizes, that money just goes back into the pot.
Oh no.
Get on. Oh, yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cecilia, is there, if people want to find out more information about what Baldor is doing and kind of some, you know, interesting stuff about the infrastructure growth, where can they go?
We actually have a fantastic website, and I don't know if people who, like, active customers of Baldor know about this website, but we went through a total website revamp in 2014. It's baldorfood.com. And in 2015, we are doing a 2.0 revamp so that the website is going to be fully transactional. It's going to be like Fresh Direct for chefs. So you'll be able to go on. It's going to have beautiful photos of every single item that we have available for next day. You'll be able to like put the items in your cart. You'll be able to do cool stuff like build custom menus so that if you're ordering the same thing from Baldur 3 days a week, you can just hit click and your whole order will go through and you can just have like a standard order.
I still don't understand how I'm dealing with these companies when doing like these giant orders and we're still calling and leaving a voicemail. Like, but I can go on Seamless and go beep, beep, beep,
food
beep, beep.
Distribution
and,
is so old school. And
I'm going to fax that over to you, Cecilia.
Yeah. What other industry like heavily still uses the fax machine?
Yeah.
But this website is going to be amazing. So everyone should check out valdorfood.com.
You've never received a fax from me. I'm anti-fax. I've never faxed once at Momo, I swear.
Thank God.
I don't even text. I just fax. Yeah. I'm Heritage Foods all the
fax
way.
Fax that over to you.
The website is beautiful. I went at it this week when
Isn't
you met.
Isn't it? It looks great. We have an amazing photographer who's doing really cool sort of photo shoots of all of our seasonal produce right now. And so, yeah, anyone who hasn't, check it out.
And maybe we can drop a couple drops for the shacks.
Please.
We have the Pickle Shack. Where can you tell us where it is?
The Pickle Shack is on 4th Avenue in Brooklyn between President and Carroll.
Awesome.
Cool. Off the Union R store.
And you're open for lunch and dinner?
Lunch and dinner and brunch.
Awesome.
We're like an insane craft beer bar. tons of crazy nerdy beer and a full menu on top of it. So
awesome.
I think I've had some fried pickles there before.
Pickle-centric. Very pickle-centric.
You're going to see me and my girlfriend Jordan over there. We love the pickles.
Please come.
Yeah. Yeah, great fried pickles. Brooklyn Brine is the parent of the Pickle Shack. So, yeah, a lot awesome. Of great Brooklyn Brine pickle stuff.
So Momo Sushi Shack, Pickle Shack, the two best shacks in the world, I say.
A lot of shacks today on a Sunday.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you for having
thank you.
Us.
Jordan for sitting patiently with us and hanging out in studio.
And thank you to Liz.
As always.
Yay.
For engineering and being awesome.
All right, guys. Have a good day.
Yeah, happy Sunday.
Bye,
happy
everyone.
Sunday.
Song for the main chorus is provided by Bree Love and Chufu. It's called I Never Had.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.